They rode black Arabian stallions, their long white robes flowing like king's royal garb, their turbans covered with jewels and gold taken from the vanquished, their long curved swords hanging at their sides, ruby-encrusted handles shimmering in the burning noonday sun. They were like visions of some distant past, out of a magical world of genies, dragons, and harems with silk-covered dancing girls. But they lived here in the 21st century, and they killed. Sikh Pratha Ragdar and Sikh Seen Panchali, the generals of the Sikh army that had just won a long, drawn-out fight with the Uttar Pradesh rebel elements. They would rise again, of that both generals were sure. But it would be years. The guerrilla movement in India and Pakistan had been seriously hurt with the destruction of half their forces and the capture of their entire top staff, whose heads now sat atop long spikes lining the roads of northern India, like signposts to hell. Panchali stroked his silver beard, which came to a point halfway down his broad chest, set in a face as weather-beaten as a piece of driftwood, surveyed the immense mountainscape that surrounded them. For the last 6 months, they had pursued the enemy right up into the Himalayas, seeking to wipe them out. The highest peaks in the world poked through the clouds, their tops disappearing above the ken of mortal man. In any direction, they could see for over 100 miles in air that was as clear and cool as a mountain spring. Snow dotted the slopes around them, and higher glacial ice sheets, 1 billion tons worth, always threatening to avalanche and bury everything in their path.
General Ragdar, I feel a deep sadness in my heart on this day.
What sadness could be found on a day like this? We have just won a war. We are rich. We are generals of 250,000 men who are feared throughout Asia. We have all the women, all the wine a man could drink. We are surrounded by the most beautiful terrain on all of God's poisoned earth, and yet you feel sadness.
I mourn because there is not more war. To fight, to die, what is life for but these?
Ah, but what a fine food, gems, slaves, love, women.
Love is for rabbits. For me, women are just intermissions between the main act of war. I am quickly bored. But tell me, do you not feel most alive in battle? With all your senses heightened, sped up, so that every image, every sound and scent is imbued with power. Power in which men, worlds, civilizations come and go in the flash of an eye, in a second. When a man comes at me with his sword, I feel transcended, lifted from my body. I can see it all in slow motion, sense everything. Can see the foam bubbling up from his steed's mouth. See the way the hoof strikes the ground at an odd angle, and how my enemy's face is filled with 1,000 conflicting emotions. This is my art, my love. The beauty of the fight, of one man against another. No chance to grow old. When my reflexes go, then my enemy will win. And he should. And I will go into the realm of the gods, of Vishnu, of Brahma and Shiva, where I'm sure we will all continue to fight amidst the clouds.
Well said. Perhaps you should have been a poet, not a warrior.
Ah, but I fear, rather than creating images of beauty, I would instead take my pen and begin stabbing at whoever came near.
Both men laughed at the image and looked at each other with a love that brothers have for one another. Although they were not related by blood, they had fought side by side for the last decade. They had worked their way up in the ranks of the Royal Sikh Army, the royal in the name being a vestige of the old imperial days of the British Empire, when the Sikhs had been the fiercest of the colonial English fighters, and had gained a worldwide reputation for their ferocity, bravery, and keen military intelligence. The Russians gave them wealth, power, and masses of weapons and ammunition. In return, they took on the enemies of the New World Soviet Empire, those barbarian tribes that Moscow felt were the most threatening.
There is truth in what you say. Battle does quicken the heart, speed up all the faculties. Yet, I do it more as my vocation. Yes, I love it, but I love other things as well, Panchali. Spreading the legs of young, beautiful women, drinking the best brandies and wines, painting pictures of the sea from my mansion near Calcutta. These things all make me feel alive.
You are much too sensitive, my young Sikh warrior. I'm amazed you have lasted this long in the business. A career of killing can take a lot out of a man if he thinks about it too long. I prefer to do what I am best at and leave the fate wheel, the judgments, to the gods.
They came to a plateau and let the stallions rest for a minute, while the two generals stood on the edge looking down at the plain below them. The tents of their troops stretched on for miles in even rows of round goatskin dwellings. The corrals for their stallions set every quarter mile or so. The men were walking outside, barely visible specks from the general's vantage point, spread out around the camps and environs like an army of ants. Only these ants weren't working, but sitting, reading, wrestling, or swimming in a nearby lake.
I am bored already. Look at our men, wallowing in idle luxury.
Surely, after our efforts for the past 6 months, they deserve a rest.
We are soldiers. We fight so that others may recline. Soldiers should not sit, rest, sleep in the middle of the day. I have lived too long as a fighter, a general, not to feel sickened by the sight of my men without their guns, their swords, ready. Perhaps I am already becoming an anachronism, obsolete as the empire collapses all around us.
Not obsolete, Panchali. Just too successful for your own good. We just vanquished one army, took back an entire nation into the arms of Mother Russia. Congratulate yourself. Let your own flesh rest for a moment. I have a whole new shipment of young, ripe girls from the southern steppes, and they are beautiful, Panchali, with huge brown eyes like a fawn and skin with the texture of the finest Peking silk. There are too many for me. I am not greedy. I will give you 4 or 5. Get your mind off all this peace.
Perhaps I could enjoy some exertion. Are we expecting company?
No. I told the men to leave us be unless there is an emergency.
Sikh Panchali! Sikh Panchali! Here, an urgent message direct from the Premier.
From the Premier? What is it?
Sir, I know it sounds peculiar, but we decoded the message 3 times and asked for confirmation. And it is accurate.
Give me the message.
What does it say?
To Sikh Generals Panchali and Ragdar, Premier Vasili wishes you to take the entire 1st Royal Sikh Army by transport jet to the USSA, where you will join forces with the American Free Fighters and battle Colonel Kilov, who has attacked Red Army bases throughout the country.
What? I can hardly believe it. We'll have to send back the women, the wines.
And fight once more. The wheel of karma spins again. We fight again, Ragdar. My wishes have come true. I will have to sample your gourmet treat some other day.
But to fight alongside the rebel American free fighters, it is all so strange.
But as for me, Sikh Ragdar, I don't give a damn who we fight, as long as we get the chance once more to sever heads from their infidel bodies.
Shit, we're gonna have to go around it.
Ted Roxon pointed at the rim wall of a mile-wide A-bomb crater that loomed ahead, blocking their way north to Fort Minsk. He pulled the reins of his bridge slightly to the right, and the long, straggly line of free fighters fell in behind him. Since his conversation with Premier Vasili, the Doomsday Warrior had actually begun believing that they had a chance to thwart Kilov's coup d'etat. Even Rona and Kim, riding right behind him as if to make sure he heard their every biting word, didn't irritate Roxon today. For the first time in days, he felt in a positively good mood.
My, you're looking well today, considering.
Oh yes, and you too. When one realizes that you're in your mid-30s and still surprisingly attractive, why those sun lines, or wait, they're crow's feet. Well, they're hardly noticeable. Well, maybe in bright light. It really is amazing.
And amazing that your diminutive twig of a body hasn't crumpled out here in the real world.
All right, you two. We're going around some high slopes here, with lots of loose rocks and boulders just itching to slide down if the right sound waves hit them. You know, sound waves like you two prattling on endlessly.
They both looked at him with burning eyes, angry at him, at each other, at everything, but clamped their lips tight as vices, the skin turning white and stiff in repressed rage. The team spread out about 30 yards apart. It was the standard formation for any potential landslide terrain, so the entire team wouldn't be buried. They rode about 100 feet from the base of the crater, still strewn with shiny green glass balls, dirt and stone melted by the bomb blast a century ago. The jewels of the atomic age. Whenever Roxon passed one of the many craters that scarred the face of America, he got the same feeling. A sensation of dread, of darkness, so deep it filled the pit of his stomach, his heart, with waves of nausea and doom. He swore he could feel the souls of those who had died from the blast, those whose ashes were mixed into the mountain.
Jeez, the spooky one.
Yeah, you can feel it too?
I can. It's like this whole place is haunted, filled with ghosts, all glued to this spot, crying for release from their pain.
I know. First thing, once President Langford takes over, is to get rid of these pus-filled wounds. Our country will never heal, never grow fully green again as long as they exist. It would help lower the rad level anyway, to fill them in.
Amen.
Oh, I can feel them too.
That's nice, Kim.
Hold up, everybody.
What was that?
I don't know. Easy, boy.
There.
Rock put his ear to the soil, and his face drained of color. Mutant Psi instinct sent shivers up his spine.
I don't know exactly what it is, but something bad is about to happen.
Everybody, we're getting the hell out of here!
Not another earthquake!
Just keep running, everybody!
But the team needed no more motivation than they were already getting, and flew along, their feet barely touching the ash and gravel ground.
What the hell? Rock! This isn't an earthquake!
Then what the hell?
A huge crater shot up a torrent of fiery dust and glowing rocks. Clouds of spewing gas and particles settled over the free fighters, blotting out the sky, making it as dark as a moonless night. Riders instinctively slowed their horses, knowing how easy it would be to trip and break a leg.
Throw the rope to the man in front of you! We've got to tie the bricks together or we're goner!
As the team continued slowly forward through the blizzard of black, ropes were tossed and anchored around the saddle horns. Safely tethered, Roxon built up speed, literally pulling the rest behind. The blind leading the blind. They'd have to get out fast.
Use your neckerchiefs! Keep from breathing the gas!
Each person took their strips of cloth, doused them with water, and tied them around their faces. The noxious fumes would be as deadly as the magma bubbling over a half a mile away from them. The nostrils of the Brids had closed, using an evolutionary adaptation of small chambers in their nasal cavities to filter out particles. But even the multi-talented mutant mouth mammals couldn't filter out the gas. Behind them, the spout of red and white-hot lava material spewed forth, shooting off for miles in every direction. Rock kept on in the direction he had been heading. They could circle back toward Fort Minsk later. Now, he was more concerned with survival. He turned and could just make out Rona and her tethered Brid following quickly behind him. Her head was wobbling from side to side, but as her eyes caught his, she gave a feeble nod to show she was conscious. Roxon motioned for her to check Kim, and slowly, as if half asleep, the red-haired free fighter twisted around in her saddle to check her love adversary. Rock swung forward again and tried to see through the cocoon of volcanic debris that completely encased them now, in search of obstacles. They'd gone about a mile and a half when the ash fog grew less dense. The prairie came into view, stretching off flat and featureless, bathed with the diffused glow of the obscured sun and the fire of the orange mouth of the volcano. Roxon looked around, at last able to see the full team, still roped together, stretching back 50 yards. Everyone was still hanging on, though some of them looked ready for embalming, draped over their Brid's shoulders, face forward like they were out cold. But it was what was coming up behind them that caught Roxon's horrified eye. A tidal wave of lava was sweeping forward, setting ablaze every tree, every cactus, every scurrying plains creature that it encountered. A wall of searing mud and molten rock, 5 feet high, burning across the landscape from every side of the crater. And it was coming straight toward them at a fast clip, faster than they were moving. Bubbles and hellish foam licking along the tops of the red waves.
Faster, dammit, faster! Yeah!
The rest of the team somehow jerked along and kept pace, their heads pulled forward by the nylon rope of the Brit ahead. They had no choice. If just one fell now, all would perish. The volcanic lava, though still a half mile off, radiated blistering heat. Rock scanned forward, searching for anything, when he saw a thin blue line off to the right. As they drew closer, the blue grew richer and wider, and the lapping waves became real water as a river came into view.
That was the biggest one yet!
We've almost made it to the river. We're gonna have to cross it.
The sky darkened to a deep yellow, the toxins and ash settling over everything. The Brits turned a dull gray as they walked. They reached the bank of the river, which was 100 feet wide at this juncture, and raging like a wildcat with rapids creating a billowing foam of whitecaps.
Archer! Hold on, Snorter! Archer!
The bear-sized mountain man finally heard him. He cut his rope loose and came flying out of the middle of the pack atop his own monstrous steed.
Roxan! Archer, there's a wide oak tree on the other side of this river. You see it? Shoot one of your cable arrows into it. You understand me?
Archer, shoot tree!
He reached around behind him and took a narrow but deep spool from one of his saddlebags and attached the quarter-inch alloy cable to the back end of the arrow, resting it in the firing slot. Putting one leg up on the Brit's neck, Archer positioned the front of the yard-wide crossbow on his knee and sighted up. His target was a gnarled, age-old tree, 6 feet wide at the base. The mountain man let his body settle, waiting several seconds until his arms stopped shaking from the adrenaline rush. Then he gently squeezed the trigger. The specially designed arrow sank in 8 inches, burying itself forever in the dense wood fiber.
Archer wins!
Yeah, good job, Archer. Give it to me.
Yeah.
Rock grabbed the spool of cable from Archer's hands, running over to a large tree by the shore. Rock wrapped the thin steel mesh cable, tested at up to a ton for tensile strength, around the wide trunk.
Detroit! Yeah, Rock! Pass the message along. We're crossing the river. I'll go first. And have everybody take their link-up ropes from their saddlebags. Everybody has one. Slip the lower clamp around the saddle ring, and when you get your Brit into the water, fit the other clamp around the wire. Don't screw up or you're dead. You got that?
Yeah, Rock. I'll pass it along.
Thanks, Detroit. Remember, there's no second chances. Make sure they know that.
Rock headed back to his mount.
Come on, boy. We're gonna take a swim. Pull you down, sir.
Rock guided his Brit towards the cable and slipped on the hinge point. Now they wouldn't get swept away and drown. They'd just get burned to death. Snorter swam forward, guided by the constant tug of the cable, as Roxon spun around on his saddle so he was facing the other way. The rest of the team steered their mounts into the river, one after another, hitting the blue with splashes of white, and then linking up. They all seemed to be doing it right, and the cold water rushing over them woke them up with frigid slaps. As Snorter swam toward the center of the river, it grew rougher, the whitecaps bigger, hitting hard. They slammed into the Brit's side, trying to sweep it downriver. The huge animal slowed to a crawl as it fought furiously beneath the surface with all four legs, paddling the wide oars at a fast pace. The whole lower portion of the mammal's body was pulled sideways by the current, forcing it to swim at a nearly 45-degree angle. But swim it did, never faltering, never doubting it could make it. The massive mountain of fire was moving right up to the other bank, snapping a grove of trees 200 yards off and chewing them down like flies. At last, the Brit touched solid ground and hoisted itself up out of the water.
Keep going, everybody! You're almost there!
Rock looked out to the river towards the sound. Somehow, one of the clasps had come loose from the cable, and a man and animal were instantly swept beneath the wire and down the river. Roxanne squinted to see who it was. Williams, one of the siege experts Rock had picked for the mission. Williams, tied to his mount, disappeared beneath a white cap, the Brit's legs spinning over several times before vanishing into the lower reaches. Knowing the man was dead, Roxanne turned his gaze back to the litter. The rest of the party was struggling, but somehow forging their way across. Within 60 seconds, most of them were up on the shore, McCaughlin bringing up the rear.
Come on, McCaughlin! The lava's almost to the shore! That anchor tree's gonna go up in smoke!
Jesus, fuck! I'm fucking swimming hard as I can! I've got three ribs tied to me! Do you want me to jump and lose all our food?
I want you to live, is what I want! Now hurry up and swim!
McCaughlin steeled himself, smacking his brid and kicking along with it. The other animals, dead tired, were practically dragged along. As Rock saw the tree he had tied the cable to smolder and its leaves turn black, McCaughlin's steed hit the bank and awkwardly started to walk its way up. The anchor tree went up in flame and the cable went slack. It splashed into the water, whipping around like a snake in the white water. Finally, the river of fire met the river of water behind them. The sky filled with smoke and steam from the concussive rendezvous.
McCaughlin, you ready to go?
Is the river not going to stop the lava?
I'd rather not be here to find out. Mount up, everybody! Come on, people! Moan about it while you're riding!
Rock headed the team away from the river.
All right, team. Take a break.
The team halted and turned their brids around, looking at the volcano. It was eerily beautiful from a distance, now that they knew it wouldn't burn them alive. It spouted up a geyser of fire in a perfectly shaped plume that had stabilized at a height of about 800 feet. It erupted with a fiery grace, its sheets of flame forming a flower-like shape before cresting and falling back down in wide symmetrical curves onto the sea of red rock below. The gases of the volcano formed an immense brown hemisphere of soot that covered the land for 20 miles around the spouting center. 12 hours later, Roxanne and his party could still see the fountain of burning rock gushing into the sky. Rock had decided to make a wide circle around the perimeter of the gas. Everyone on the team had already breathed too much of the stuff, and they were all looking a little green around the gills. It would add a day to their journey to Fort Minsk, but they were ahead of schedule by nearly 2 days and could afford the delay. So they headed east for a half a day and then north again. The land grew thick with vegetation, small ponds and animals, unicorn deer, poison quilled porcupines, flying squirrels with feathered wings, all moved in nature's harmony around the weary fighters. Toward night, they bagged a big buck and roasted it over a spitfire, cutting off huge chunks and wolfing them down like savages. Rock had okayed the feast. The men needed a rest, some good food, and the nurturing warmth of a fire. They were smack in the middle of nowhere, with no red forts for 100 miles. It would be safe. It would have to be. One couldn't go on endlessly without some sort of respite, some relief. They slept under the trillion-starred sky. Rona and Kim continued to lie on each side of Roxanne, but far enough away so it didn't appear that either of them was on the make for him. It was just accidental that their sleeping sacks ended up there. A biting wind from the north made them all burrow deep into their synth-down bags, but it also cleared away much of the sulfur and other gases that the earth had regurgitated. By morning, after a night of breathing the clear frosty air, everyone was alert and bright-eyed, their lungs cleaned out. The attack team broke camp and headed out. Rona and Kim went at it almost instantly once they hit the trail.
Darling, I had the most frightful dream about you last night.
Oh, really? How fascinating.
Yes, you turned into a giant spider and were waving all these hairy legs at everyone.
Oh, I didn't try to eat you, did I? Spiders do eat little weak fruit flies.
Oh, you tried, so I had to shoot you. I felt terrible about it. Apologized to everyone. But there it was. You had turned into a giant, ugly spider. It wasn't my fault.
Oh, little one. In a million years, if every second of them was your lucky day, you couldn't take me with a howitzer in each hand. I'd split your sweet head open with one chop. Of course, only in a dream.
But, darling, I left my howitzers at home. Prefer to use one of my 45s.
Come on, you two. No one in my outfit talks about doing someone else in, no matter how much they're playing around. Okay? Keep your barbs friendly.
Oh, of course, Rock.
I'm so sorry, Ted.
Rona batted her eyebrows innocently, and the Doomsday Warrior couldn't help but smile. He still had no better way of dealing with either of them but to grin idiotically and say nothing. He crossed his fingers. Somehow, the thing would work itself out. Thank God they had a war to fight. Both were back at it again within minutes, unable to resist the nasty temptation, like a moth flying closer and closer to the flame, testing its wings to see what it will take to stoke them into fire.
Little one, no one on the team has the nerve to say it, but when are you going to wash those fatigues? They're starting to, well, smell rather strong.
Wash them? Oh, yes. I had planned to back at the river, but a volcano so rudely interrupted me. But I guess your clothes keep fresher longer.
Kim looked up and down at the form-fitting spandex combat bodysuit Rona was wearing.
But then there's a need to emphasize the body parts that prove your masculine body is really female, so it's no wonder. I think you need a few repairs, though. You're busting at the seams in a few places there. Guess they couldn't take the strain of that buffalo bottom and those thunder thighs.
Listen, you great-chested little...
Hold it. I hear something.
They had entered a long, lush valley with slopes of trees rising several hundred feet on each side. Rock looked sharply around the hillsides, covered with little islands of thorned bush, and up to the tree line along the top ridges. It would be the perfect place for an ambush.
Battle status. Look for anything.
I see them.
Where? Ah.
Rock stared down the center of the valley in the direction they had been heading. He had to resist the urge to rub his eyes, for standing in their way, mounted on 20 Palominos, was a war party of American Indians. They sat impassively, frozen like statues atop their equally motionless steeds. Their faces and arms were covered with stripes and designs, slashes of red and blue and green that crisscrossed over their bodies, giving them a fierce and demonic appearance. On their heads sat feathered headdresses with rows of multicolored feathers from at least a dozen different species falling over their broad copper shoulders and down their backs.
Indians? I can't believe it. No one's seen them since the war. They were thought to be extinct.
Except for that damnable crazy alligator tribe.
These look like the real thing, though.
They, don't look too friendly. I don't think that stuff on their faces is for cosmetic beauty.
No, it's war paint. Definitely war paint. And something tells me we've been picked to be the guys on the receiving end. But hold your fire. Maybe they'll let us pass.
Oh, shit! Return fire!
The sheer firepower of the free-fighting forces sent the Indians on the run as they ripped their brids around and hightailed it along the valley floor.
Free fighters, attack!
Oh, shit.
The ridges on each side of the valley were filled with horse-mounted warriors holding rifles in their arms. They stretched in long lines on both sides, 200 feet above Roxon, who took in the scene with cold eyes, realizing they had been tricked. He remembered a film about General Custer, starring Errol Flynn, that he'd seen back in Century City. The cavalrymen had been suckered in exactly this way, and then surrounded by thousands of braves. And he and his men had been massacred. One of the younger chiefs, identifiable by his immense feather bonnet, rode down, holding a war staff high in the air. He came down the slope at a slow, even pace, not batting an eyelash, as if he didn't care whether the men below fired at him or not, whether he lived or died. Several of the free fighters sighted through their scopes.
Don't shoot, damn it! But keep your arms ready. Don't give them anything unless they ask for it. Hello. We're free fighters on our way to fight.
Friendly guy.
Ease up, everybody. Don't make a move. Act relaxed. And smile. Nelson.
Yeah, Rock?
You're here for your language skills. See if you can talk to him.
Sure, Rock. I'll give it a try, but I ain't promising.
The ruddy-faced linguist began making a variety of sign language signals with his hands, a language the Anthro boys swore was an exact rendering of the 1800s Indian sign language. The Indian looked on in scorn at first, but then, recognizing a sign here and there, responded with various fists, arm arrangements, and finger patterns. Within a minute, the two men were exchanging rapid sequences of silent signals. To Roxon, the gestures seemed a lot like the ancient Buddhist mudras he had studied. At last, the Indian stopped and let his arms fall to his sides, once again looking at Roxon with utmost contempt, as if he were a bug that should be squashed. Nelson turned to the Doomsday Warrior, a solemn look on his usually jovial face.
The situation is more or less either we surrender to them, their Sioux, immediately and throw down our weapons, or they'll slaughter us to a man. I tried all kinds of things on him, even bribery, but these guys got their minds made up. I mean, look around you.
Roxon didn't have to. He had seen war parties from other kinds of tribes, other societies. They didn't go home empty-handed. He quickly juggled the odds in his head. He and his men had some heavy artillery. Their liberators, grenades, McCaughlin's 50 cal packed away on one side of a supply grid, but instantly usable. Yet, he surveyed both hills again, not even able to see the end of either line of braves, their eyes all staring intently on the meeting. There was no way in hell he and his men would come out victorious. It would be another Custer's last stand, another massacre. He grimaced, remembering a book he had read about esoteric Comanche torture skills. But what could they do?
We're surrendering, folks.
You can't be serious.
Yes. Keep any hidden weapons you have on you, but drop the liberators and pistols. It's certain death to shoot it out here. We don't have to prove our heroics. There'll be a second chance, I promise you.
The chief, who had been conducting the sign language, held the war staff to the sky and waved it in the air. The braves on the valley slopes descended, a blanket of thousands covering the valley slopes.
What now, brave leader?
Nelson, what do the Sioux do with their prisoners?
Well, from what I picked up, we're not just prisoners. We're being taken to, exact revenge.
Great.
By the time the Sioux had brought the team to their village, it was nighttime. The volcano past the horizon had finally stopped erupting, though the plume of smoke was still visible through the hazy atmosphere. Buffalo hide teepees stretched off in long, uneven rows like pine cones, fallen from winter branches, as Roxon and the free-fighting expedition were led into the Sioux village. Squaws came out to greet the returning heroes and jeer at their captives. The freedom fighters were paraded through the entire camp like they were the best thing to happen to these people in years.
Probably don't get too many prisoners around here, so they want to get every bit of mileage out of it they can.
Just pretend you're a hero being welcomed home, rather than a prisoner about to be acupunctured with arrows, and you'll feel fine.
Oh yeah, yeah, feel better already.
At last, the Indians grew tired of the public display, and the prisoners were taken to the central square. There, in the middle of the square, was a huge bonfire with flames licking 40 feet in the air. A constant stream of young buckskin squaws kept coming out of the surrounding woods, carrying armloads of dead wood and branches to feed the flames. Medicine men danced around the fires wearing whole buffalo heads, horns, fake eyeballs, swollen white tongues and all, the thick brown fur necks falling almost to their stomachs. They yelled out the deep, magical incantations of their ancestor spirits and called on the buffalo gods to grant their wishes. The free fighters were taken down from their brids and led to a long, horizontal hitching pole, where their bound hands were promptly tied behind their backs along the 30-foot length. Their legs were still free, but they certainly couldn't run anywhere. The victorious braves dismounted and gathered in front of them, some of their feather headdresses hanging down nearly to their ankles. Hunting knives dangled from their rawhide belts, and intricately ornamented rifles from their shoulders. Several of the younger men were pointing at Kim and Rona, tied next to each other. They cast lascivious glances and whispered private jokes to one another. The young chief who had demanded their surrender back in the valley walked over to Nelson, untied him, and began communicating with the hand signs again.
What's he saying?
His name is Shamgana. He wants to know who we are.
Tell him everything. Tell him the truth. Our only chance is to get these fellows on our side. Tell him we're Americans, like him and his people, and our only enemy is the Reds. Shit, tell him we're happy to make his acquaintance.
Metaphysical concepts like enemy and truth are a little hard to communicate.
Try, damn it!
The rest of the tribe looked on, mystified by the captive's motions. Shamgana responded in rapid, sharp gestures.
He says that he and his people, they are the real Americans. That the white man came and stole his land and nearly destroyed it. Now his people, the new Sioux Nation, will take it all back again.
Tell him he's right. Tell him every fucking word he's saying is true. That our ancestors made many mistakes and committed injustices. But now we face a threat that will destroy us all, even the gods in the clouds.
Again, Nelson made signals to the chief. Sweat beaded his forehead as he made sure not to send the wrong signal. As the chief returned with his own motions, the blood drained from Nelson's face.
Roxanne?
Just tell me.
He says, not only did we screw up the whole world, but that our coming across the sacred plains angered the volcano god, and it erupted because of us. And he says they have to sacrifice us to the god of fire now to set things right again.
Oh, great. Of fucking course they do.
One of the older chiefs, his face wrinkled and impassive, raised his hand high, palm out. 10 other top Indian war chiefs, sitting on deerskin chairs below him, waited for the proceedings to begin. 3 gigantic braves, with muscles rippling like steel cables, came and untied the captive on the right side of the pole.
What? Me? No!
It was Thalsberg, one of the youngest men Rock had brought along. He had chosen him due to his sharpshooting ability and his knowledge of Russian fortification architecture.
No! Please! Let me go! Let me go!
The Braves took a blow and grabbed his legs, trussing him up with tight rawhide bindings.
No, please!
Thalsberg writhed in the Indian's grasp like a creature possessed, twisting his hips, whipping his head around, trying to smash them. But it was all to no avail. The Braves walked with their human package right up to the edge of the roaring fire, 20 feet in diameter, flames rising high into the dark sky.
Nelson, do something!
Rock, I'm trying! Nothing I'm saying is getting through to them!
The eldest chief's hand came down.
No! Please no! Rock! Do something! Save me!
The coals and flames ripped into Thalsberg's body like ravenous teeth and set the skin aboil. From their vantage point, every one of the prisoners could clearly see the flesh turn red at first, then brown, then black as it burst into an oily flame. And the man's face, the lips pulled back so far that the gums and all the teeth were visible as the mouth stretched open, impossibly wide. Within 15 seconds, the screams had stopped, and the body shook violently before falling limp. All the flesh was quickly consumed by the intense heat, and the bones poked through, the marrow bubbling out the ends and dropping in sizzling pops onto the logs below. Rock's eyes were moist as he realized that he had made the wrong choice. Now they were all going to die like that, and he was responsible. It was one of the very few times in his life that the Doomsday Warrior wished he was dead, so he wouldn't have to see what was going to happen next. One of the junior chiefs suddenly moved forward toward the prisoners. He headed right for Kim and looked down at her with bestial lust. Then he reached for her field jacket.
What are you... Hey! You get off her!
Mona, Kim, if he so much as fucking moves for you, you stomp on his head, okay?
Okay.
Are you two okay?
Yeah, Rock.
Good. Nelson.
Yeah, Rock.
They're not happy about what just happened, are they?
Are you kidding? Are you fucking hearing them right now?
Tell them. Nelson, tell them I challenge their gods.
Tell them what?
Tell them I demand the right as a warrior to take the test of the gods. You hear me?
Yeah. Okay, Rock.
Nelson frantically tried to get the idea across to the Indian he had been signaling with, who stood, arms folded impassively across his painted chest, 2 yards in front of him. Sham Gana looked at Nelson's hands almost in spite of himself. Once Nelson was done signaling, he stepped forward.
Hold!
He signaled angry messages with quick, stiff fingers.
Nelson, what did he say?
Rock, I don't know what your demand meant.
What did he say, Nelson?
It worked. I don't know what it means, but he told me they're not going to kill us now. And he said that the initiator of the challenge should come forward to meet his maker.
Good work.
It's me. I am the challenger.
An Indian walked forward and cut Roxon free from the pole. He motioned for Nelson to follow, and the three of them walked through the ominously silent masses of braves until they reached Chief Brightsun and his 10-man ruling council. The top chief signed a few signals, which Nelson translated.
He wants to know how you know about the challenge of the gods. How the hell did you know anyway?
All tribes the world over have challenges, ways to avoid certain death. I took a chance. What do we have to lose? But don't tell him that. Tell him that I have great magic. Powerful, explosive magic. That I made the volcano erupt because I wanted it to. That how else could we have come from that direction unless I was top magic man?
Tell him, Rock Magic Man?
Just tell him all that. Don't worry how it sounds.
The nervous free fighter made his hand signals again. He and his Sioux counterpart quickly understanding one another's gestures now and communicating in seconds with a flurry of fingers and palms. Roxon kept his eyes fixed firmly on the top chief's face to see his reaction as the words were translated. The prune-faced man's pupils seemed to dilate for a second, as if from fear. But the old man had been through too many poker games of nerves with his own upstarts and would-be assassins to buckle under Roxon's gaze. He looked straight back, focused on Roxon without a flicker of emotion. But the Doomsday Warrior knew that he had affected him, knew that magic, superstition, their fears of things they didn't understand, were his ace in the hole. After a minute, Nelson turned to the Doomsday Warrior.
Well, you've got your wish, Rock. The challenge of the buffalo, as they call it, whatever it is, you're gonna get a chance to find out real soon.
Thanks, Nelson. Whatever happens, you did good. Real good.
4 hulking braves appeared and hoisted Roxon, 2 on a side, and carried him to the center of a circle about 50 feet in diameter. The Doomsday Warrior looked around curiously, wondering just what the hell was going to happen next, and started to work his hands completely free so he could take on whatever was coming. From out of a 30-foot-high teepee surrounded by buffalo skulls came a whole crew of the biggest of the young braves. Over the tops of their bodies were buffalo heads with eyes, fur, and horns as long and sharp as daggers. The 10 Sioux held bludgeon-sized tomahawks. They quickly came over to the circle and lined up on the perimeter until they were evenly distributed around Roxon. Then they came in slowly, ever closer, for the kill. The Doomsday Warrior's face fell. He looked up for a split second toward the sky, launching an appeal to a hopefully compassionate god who he prayed was in a good mood today. He finally wriggled his flexible mutant hands free of the leather thongs. This was not going to be easy. No, he couldn't doubt himself. Couldn't think about getting them all at once. Just one at a time. That's all. One at a time. Or so the little pep talk he gave himself went. The entire group came charging forward, their buffalo heads pointed straight ahead, polished curved horns reaching for his flesh, tomahawks flailing. Rock shot between 2 of them, kicking the legs out from under one brave as he went. He slid behind the body so that the horned braves didn't realize that their prey had ducked them. Rock slid his hands down the downed Indian's side and felt a handle. He ripped it free, and with something approaching joy, saw that it was a long 16-inch hunting knife. Someone up there liked him, or at least wanted to draw the contest out a bit.
Thanks, buddy.
Rock thought for a second of dashing over to free his imprisoned team, but took one glance at the mob of Indians and thought better of it. There was still only one way out of this, and that was by killing all 10 champions. Every one of the bastards, who were just realizing that their prey had vanished. Before the 9 warriors left standing could turn, Rock ran several yards toward the Titan circle had attacked from the rear. The man dropped to the ground, his spinal cord severed. Roxon was honestly surprised nobody had seen or heard his approach. The buffalo heads must be impeding their vision and hearing. There was a chance after all. The rest, realizing their charge had missed its mark, turned. The closest brave leapt madly forward, trying to split Rock's skull with his tomahawk. Rock ducked, and the Indian's groin met Rock's booted foot. The man, though not dead, was certainly not getting up anytime soon. Roxon felt a tingle on his back and knew instinctively to move. As he spun to one side, a buffalo's horn slashed across his torso, taking a chunk of meat with it. Had he been an instant later, the horn would have taken a kidney along with it. As the champion dug his feet in the ground to turn, Rock shot his blade through the buffalo's neck. The Indian slammed forward, the buffalo helmet falling off to reveal bloody holes in the back and front of the man's neck. Blood bubbled from both, the man's eyes almost popping out in pain. A pair of horns came at him from the side, catching Roxon slightly off balance. Seeing he had no time, the Doomsday Warrior, instead of trying to evade the attack, helped it along. Rock fell back, grabbed hold of both horns, and kicked out as he fell. The champion flew 2 yards behind Rock. As Rock went after the downed man, another set of horns rushed from the circle. Roxon turned and thrust his hunting blade to meet the skull of the oncoming locomotive. The remaining champion backed off a bit. The Doomsday Warrior wiped his eyes with his sleeve as he walked slowly backwards in a low-legged horse stance, ready for the next attack. The entire battle had lasted hardly a minute so far, and Rock had no idea how many he'd taken out. But as he wheeled, he saw only 4 of the huge heads confronting him from the sides of the circle. He realized that the odds were coming round. Maybe he'd even live. The wound in his side sent a shiver of sharp pain through his nerves, and Roxon winced as he felt a thin stream of blood oozing down his leg and into his boot, making it simultaneously sticky and slippery inside. He used the bolt of pure pain to charge him up, to push his adrenaline to even higher levels, his senses to a peak. Then he waited for them to make the next move. The 4 buffalo heads looked around at each other, alarmed to see how many the white man had killed. None had ever done so well before. For the first time in their entire lives, the 4 knew real heart-pounding fear as they realized that their own lives were suddenly very much at stake. They started forward, trying to fence him in, and ended with the piercing of 8 horns into his flesh. But Rock had trained for years in fighting multiple opponents. For the more there were of them, the more their movements, not his, were confined, the more chance there was for an opening. He saw it. As they closed to within feet of him, one of the braves stumbled slightly and went half down on one knee. Instantly, Rock jumped over the man. Rock turned without even coming to a stop and jumped up onto the buffalo man's back. Now he had a mount, and he'd use it. He wrapped his left arm around the brave's throat and jabbed at the man's lower back. The Indian shot forward as if a hot poker was up his ass, crashing right into another man, horns first. The man his mount had stabbed dropped to the dirt, his body spurting blood, staining the dirt crimson. Rock immediately swung his knife down, the tip of a 16-inch blade slicing open the back of his mount's right knee. The unwilling mount's arterial spray joined the spreading pool of blood on the ground. Rock saw one of the remaining two men take a flying leap towards him. The horns spread to either side so he couldn't strafe out of the way. He kicked out his own feet, dropping to the ground. As the Indian flew directly above him, Roxon held his knife straight up, dead center of the airborne body, and watched it dig a messy, ragged furrow. The man's chest became a plowed field of flesh, from which a crop of blood and lungs instantly grew. He came down several yards past Roxon, leaving a trail of red foam on the packed ground. Rock turned, searching for more Sioux attackers, but could find only dead or barely moving bodies around the now blood-soaked ritual circle of combat. Then he saw the last of them at the far side of the circle. He had thrown his buffalo mask from his head and shoulders and was backing away from Roxon. One of the men watching stepped into the circle, a bow and arrow in his hands. The last fighter quickly took it and started to draw the bow. Seeing that there was no referee for Roxon to appeal to about the disobeying of challenge of the buffalo regulations, the Doomsday Warrior decided to make the judgment call on his own. He flipped the knife in the air and caught the blade. Before the brave even saw the motion, Rock brought the knife up to his shoulder, balancing it exactly two-thirds of the way down the dripping red steel, and released it with all his throwing strength. The bow fell from the man's cheating hands. Rock's throw had embedded the knife in the Indian's right eye to the hilt. The man's head seemed to cock to one side, his mouth gaping open, as if to say something. He didn't live long enough to say it. Rock rolled his shoulders, relaxing his super tense muscles, and looked around him. The place was a butcher shop of human flesh. With the buffalo heads lying around the bodies of their previous owners, the entire scene had a surreal look to it, as if it was a monument, a Stonehenge of animal and human masks, dedicated to a ceremonial proposition that any and all mortals can die at any second. Roxon was called before the assembled chiefs as Shamgana and Nelson went at it again like Martians trying to speak Greek to one another. The feathered top brass looked positively sickened at the outcome, their lips trembling, their eyes dark and filled with raging fire at the man who had destroyed their champs.
Rock, you won?
Damn right I won. Did you talk to him about the last...
No, Rock! You won the tribe! They say you are the one who it was prophesied would come, the buffalo hunter, the one capable of destroying their masked marauders there. They don't like the idea... But apparently, you're the big cheese here now. You won the place.
Shamgana gave him another flurried hand fan of messages from Chief Brightsun.
They want to know what you want to do with the village, with the women, where they should go to be imprisoned if they are to be your slaves.
Slaves? No, absolutely not. Tell him I'm not in the least bit interested in taking over this development, that he's still the boss and that all we want to do is get the hell out of here.
Nelson translated the message to the sub-chief, whose face grew brighter and brighter with each thought that was communicated. He looked to the other leaders, their faces showing little flickers of relief. The top man turned to Nelson and gave a series of motions.
The chief says you are free to go. They will give you all the supplies you want, and none of your flock will be harmed. He says he hopes they haven't, in their stupidity of your godly ways, offended you.
Tell them I'm sorry that so many of their strong men had to die. That we're all Americans. And no matter what our inglorious past together, we can only face the future living together, or we will all die alone.
Nelson translated the words into sign language, and then the response from the chief.
He says the word of the Buffalo Slayer is law now. They will no longer kill Americans. We are all brothers now.
The free fighters' weapons and brids were returned to them, loaded up with supplies of fresh fruit, meat, and replenished gourds of water. They marched through the central sandy square past the now totally silent and bowing New Sioux, who watched Roxon with eyes filled with both fear and worship. A man so strong would have been great, powerful, unbeatable magic for their tribe. And Rock swore he saw a twinkle in the eye of the old chief, thanking him for splitting the scene, and for leaving the power structure intact. They rode straight north for 16 hours without stopping, just slowing every hour for 5 minutes to give the Brids water. With good weather and no spy drones around to signal their passage, the force made excellent time, finding themselves at last within miles of their rendezvous point with the American army of several thousand men, who, if all was going according to plan, were in the final stages of setting up the invasion of Fort Minsk from the woods that surrounded it. They came to the south end of the thick forest and tramped into it, moving slowly as the branches grew lower. Roxon was just beginning to wonder where the hell his men were, and if something had gone wrong, when he heard the heartwarming challenge.
Halt! Give the password!
Silver threads!
Among the gold!
A young man stepped out from the trees. His mottled face was streaked with dirt, his hair full of sticks.
Roxon, where the hell you been? We've been crapping our pants waiting for you to get here. The attack is due to begin in 36 hours.
Well, let's not waste any more time then, pal. Ran into a few sideshows on the road. You know how it is.
The entire team breathed a sigh of relief that they had actually made it, as the journey had given them a little more action than usual. For the first time in days, their stomach muscles relaxed and their lungs filled completely with air as they realized, unwinding, that they had been coiled as tight as springs. They were led a mile through the woods, the immense Fort Minsk occasionally visible through the branches to the north of them, until they came to a camp set up beneath the trees, tents and hammocks strung along their lower limbs. The whole thing was somewhat constricting to get around in, but necessary because of their proximity to the KGB-held fortress and the occasional chopper that flew overhead. The rest of the team headed for showers, fresh clothes, and food, while Rock walked to the command post. It was a rectangular, camouflage-patterned tent that ran 50 feet long, but because of the many branches overhead, was only about 6 feet high. He pushed aside the front flaps.
We can't rest the whole siege on some goddamn... Oh, hello, Roxon. Glad you could join us.
Oh, hi, Wooster. Hello, Fenton.
Good to see you, Ruck.
I didn't know you two would be here for the siege.
If they couldn't keep us away from the most important battle in the country.
General Wooster and Colonel Fenton looked at Roxon with flat, cordial looks. The last time they had sat down for a full meeting was the night before the battle for Forrester Valley. At that meeting, Rock had suggested training the star-patterned mutants in telepathy for an unbreakable code, and it was met with the expected skepticism. That such a plan had worked and held off the invading force long enough for the glowers to swoop in had made them view Rock with begrudging dislike. The military leaders of the subterranean city had always had an uneasy alliance with Roxon. Although highly successful in his military planning and maneuvers in the past, and therefore virtually immune to criticism, the man irked them in a thousand different ways. He never wore a real uniform, never saluted, or followed any of the customary procedures and rules that were the glue of any man's army. He never had his special men march parade drill, wear regulation combat gear, or do army calisthenics or workouts of any kind. He just wasn't an army man. Yet as the living symbol of America's resistance, he had an official say and even ultimate veto over all major military moves. Not that he pulled rank. Of that they were grateful. But perhaps deep down inside the hearts of each of the brass was a wish to be like Roxon, a born and perfect warrior. But they would never admit to that.
So, where are we in the planning?
Well, Ruck, we were just discussing...
Arguing.
Whatever. Does anybody have any coffee?
Over on the table.
Thanks.
We're trying to figure out the best battle formation. We really haven't had too much experience in laying waste to a whole fortress. As you know, most of our military expeditions since Century City was founded have been hitting convoys, smaller bases. Strike, destroy, split. So none of us, in all honesty, has been really sure how to proceed. We dug up some old siege booklets from the military library back at Century City, but, well, they're obviously obsolete. So, we were just discussing about whether to send all our forces against one wall, mortar, machine gun, infantrymen, and try to bring it down, or to attack all four sides, weaken their inner forces, disperse them, and try to move in fast with a mobile commando unit and get inside. I must say I favor the one-wall scenario. We know the Minx is filled with heavy artillery up on the walls, auto-fire machine guns, rocket racks, the works. Assuming Kilov and his men can handle what they've got there, then they've got 100 times the firepower we do. Now, Wrath, because of both the risk of this attack and the danger of getting double-crossed by the Red Army troops you're bringing in, convinced the Century City Council to cut the number of free fighters for this attack by 60%.
60%?! Wrath went over my head after I left?
The decision didn't go over well, I assure you, but the council voted...
I can't believe this! Does Wrath understand what this means for our plans? This isn't some fucking hijacking operation we've got going on here. It's a goddamn war. And just because his own plan was voted down... fuck it. This isn't productive. I'll deal with it when we get back. Continue.
Right. Wait, you did manage to get in touch with the Red Army, right? We're getting enforcements, right?
Yeah. I called up Vasily himself a few days ago and convinced him to send up a battalion of Sikh fighters. His advisor, Rahala, assured me they would be here by the time we strike.
Well, good. Especially good they're not Red Army, for morale's sake at least. I don't know how well we'd fight, seeing the person next to us with a star on their shoulder and an AK in their arms. Anyway, even with the Sikh reinforcements, I think our only chance is to just keep blasting every goddamn bit of fire we possess on one section of one wall. I say we rip it apart, then get our asses in there fast.
Sounds as good as anything I could come up with. At least before I get a full rundown on our supplies. Wrath didn't cut our supplies too, did he?
Nope, that didn't pass. He may take our men, but he'll never convince the council to take our bullets.
But he tried.
That he did, Roxon. That he did.
Sirs! Sorry to interrupt. Sorry, I just ran a mile without stopping. Give me a second.
The strapping lad bent over, hands on his knees.
Kid, what's wrong?
Sorry, I ran because some people showed up at the southeast woods and sirs, they
what, boy? Spit it out!
They're weird, sirs. Weird.